world for his wildlife photography. And he has a new book that's out that's a collection of 200 images, some of the most mind-blowing photographs you will ever see, collected in one book. He's visited a lot of places around the world, every place from Borneo to the Antarctic. And we'll be talking with him about his work and about some of these photographs. And I really would urge people to, if you can, go out to the bookstore and look for the book. You can also go to his website and see some of the photos, because we will try to talk about some of them and describe some of them, but you got to see them to appreciate them. So that's in the first part of the show. Another animal-themed kind of program in hour number two, we'll be talking with Stanley Coren. He is also known around the world as an authority on the behavior of dogs, and he has a new book out, relatively new, which is titled How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. He's professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, and he'll be talking with us in hour number two. In both cases, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. All you have to do is give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just a second here, we'll get right to Steve Bloom. I'm not going to take a lot of time here at the moment, because we have been talking quite a bit here this morning about your support for the station, but if you're a listener to Focus 580 and you're not a supporter, that means a financial supporter, we hope that you would do that. We're hoping that we can hear from at least 12 people by noon today making a contribution to WILL and to Focus 580. The number to call is 244-9455, and I just would like to plant the idea in your mind that over the last few years particularly, we've seen a really serious erosion in our tax-based funding, particularly on the state level. We have cut everything that we could try to cut, but we know that the cost of operating the station will continue to go up. We are not likely to get future discounts from the program producers. All we can do is turn to the people who use the service and say to you, if you value WILL, and if you're not a financial supporter, we hope that you would do that this time around. Once again, it's 217-244-9455. That is the number to call, and we hope that you will do that this morning. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Steve Bloom. He is, as I said, he's well known around the world for his wildlife photography. He was born in South Africa and then in the mid-70s moved to England and worked there for many years in the graphics industry. In the early 90s, he decided that he wanted to become a professional nature photographer and went on to do that. And as I mentioned, he is the author, of a new book, which is titled Untamed. And it's published by Abrams. It's a very large book and has a lot of really striking photographs in it. You might head out to the bookstore and take a look at it to appreciate the work. He also does have a website where you can see some of the pictures, which is stevebloom.com. And he's talking with us this morning from where he lives in England. Mr. Bloom, hello.
Hello, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
And thanks for inviting me onto the program.
Well, it's just when the book came in, we just were stunned. I mean, everybody comes in and they look through the photographs one after another, and they're really powerful images. And anybody who has ever tried to take a photograph, I'm sure they look at the picture and they say, how in the world did he get that shot? But that's not just one picture like that. There's a couple hundred pictures like that in here. So it's really, really very powerful work.
Well, it took 10 years to do, and it's 200 pictures. So, you know, a lot of time, a lot of effort went into it. I also wanted to have a very large book. In fact, I jokingly describe it as not a coffee table book, but a coffee table. Some people, I feel, by being in such a large size, you can actually get drawn into the pictures.
I think that that's very true, and I think that, you know, one of the things that's very impressive is the feeling of closeness that you as a viewer of the photograph have to the subject. And I guess one of the things that I'm wondering is on average, how, because there are some of these animals that you just simply couldn't get that close to, how generally speaking, how far away are you from the subject?
Well, obviously it varies from picture to picture, but eye contact is very important to me. So if you've got good eye contact, then you get a feeling of closeness. You know, of course I use long lenses as well, I try to work with animals who are well habituated to people. And it's also important to use the right body language to be very aware that when you're photographing an animal, you're essentially a guest in their territories. And you must let them know that you're not going to be a threat to them in whatever way you can. And then if you're patient and you adopt the right attitude, it's possible to get quite close to them. But you should never be complacent. You know, sometimes I'd be working with animals which are quite dangerous, and I don't want to take too many chances, so I'm very careful. I also tend to take guides along with me who know the terrain and know the animals and know just how far we can push the situation without putting the animals under any stress or distressing them in any way.
So I that's one of the things that I assume that one of the techniques that you had to use, or one of the things that you had to do, was to get the animals used to your being around, so eventually they'd get to the point where if not comfortable with you there, they were at least used to the fact that you were there.
Yes, I mean, the situation varies from animal to animal. For instance, if you're photographing the mountain gorillas in the mountains in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, we had to approach very, very cautiously, and the guides would make a very specific type of grunting noise as they'd approach the gorillas to let the gorillas know that we were approaching their territory, and then they'd essentially let us in. And these were gorillas who had encountered people before. You know, so that's one situation. Another situation might be in Africa with the lions, who, as long as you stay in the car, you can actually get quite close to them without upsetting them or without them really reacting to you. So it really varies from situation to situation.
There's one early in the book, very striking photograph of a gorilla. And it takes up the pages, as you say, the book is large, the pages are large. And this, the face of the animal takes up almost an entire page. And then it's a nice composition because the rest of the page has the foliage in there, so you get a sense of the setting. But this particular photograph, it almost looks like your nose, you know, sort of as a viewer, it almost looks like your nose to nose with the animal. It's that close.
Well, there's an interesting story behind that. One of the things that set me off on this 10-year journey was I saw a gorilla in the zoo, and the gorilla looked into my eyes, and I began to think and decided I wanted to see the gorillas in the wild, as well as the chimpanzees and the orangutans, the three great apes, and I set off to Africa to photograph the gorilla in the wild, and I was very lucky to get that picture because it was a time when the Rwandan crisis was at its peak, and I couldn't go into Rwanda, so I was going in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which had its own political problems at the time. I also went in Uganda, but the sightings were very few and far between in Uganda at the time. And I had this very brief encounter where I was able to literally get quite close to the gorilla, and the gorilla looked back at me, and you know, it's from a personal point of view, it's very precious to me that I was able to go from seeing the gorilla's eyes in the zoo to actually seeing the gorilla where a gorilla should be. And in a previous book I wrote about that picture, if you gaze into the eyes of a gorilla, you'll be changed forever. Mm-hmm. And I felt that very strongly, and I was trying to get that across with that picture.
I think you succeeded. I think you succeeded very well. And there are so many photographs like that. There's another. I just happened to be looking here. There, I'm not sure if this is a leopard, if it's a cheetah. This is the photograph of the baby, which you see framed in between the body and the legs of an adult, and it looks like this little cat. Again, it looks like it's looking right at you.
Well, that was a cheetah in Namibia. And, you know, people ask me how I do it. Essentially, I shoot from the heart. I really believe that it's possible to approach photography not in a very technical way. Obviously, you have to master the technique. But for me, photography is like music. It's very much about feeling. It's very much about seeing the animals and responding to them and just shooting as if you're composing a piece of music or writing poetry. And if that's the emotional and spiritual attitude you take towards the photography, I think certain things happen, certain things which is very difficult for us to understand on an intellectual level.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is wildlife photographer Steve Bloom. If you're interested in seeing his work, you should go out to the bookstore and look for this book we're talking about here. The book is titled Untamed, and it's published by Abrams. It is a very large book, And the photographs are printed big, and they are very, very dramatic. Sampling of photos that he took, and as he said, it took 10 years to assemble these photographs. He traveled all over the world. He was in Borneo. He was in Africa. He was in Antarctica. A lot of different animals, but all really dramatic and powerful photographs. By the way, also, if you'd like to call in, as always, we're interested in questions from people who are listening, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think, in addition to there are photographs like the ones that we've talked about that are virtually portraits, there are also photographs of groups of animals and some of them in motion. And I think that they are really fascinating because of the I'm not quite sure how to describe that. For example, I'm looking here at a picture of that was taken from, I guess it must have been taken from a helicopter, of a herd of zebra, and it spreads out over four pages, so it's a panoramic photo. And the waves that go through the grass and the waves that go through the stripes of the animals, if you sort of step back and you just blur your focus just the tiniest bit, it becomes something else. And there are a lot of really striking photographs like that. Or there's also another photo of is it wildebeest, where it's a little bit fuzzy, the focus, it's very blue, it's saturated with blue, and that it's sort of misty looking, and the thing that really draws your eye are the horns of the animals, this mass of all this curling mass. And then when you look at it really closely, you realize what it's a picture of. But they're really stunning images for the way that they capture movement in a very pure way, and the way that they deliver this hit of just very pure sort of shape and motion and color. I mean, it's just really amazing.
Well, both those pictures took a long time to get. The first picture, which you spoke about, of the zebras, was done from a helicopter. And I had to wait many, many days for the light and for the weather to be right. And, in fact, I had to fly back to England, and I had only about 2 hours left. So I said to the helicopter pilot, let's just go and do it. And the light just came through just for a moment when I got that picture of the zebra. So there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of time that seems to be unproductive, but it's time that's working up to the moment when the picture comes. And the same thing happened with the wildebeest. I'd waited something like 10 days at a riverbank to photograph the great crossing of the river where a million zebras and wildebeest cross the Mara River. What they do is they follow the rainfall. But when they cross the river, they're naturally afraid of water, and the river's usually full of crocodiles. So there's a frenzy when they do it. And I just wanted to capture something of that frenzy in close-up with the picture of the wildebeest. And the light was very cold. That's why they're blue. It was an incredibly cold and dark and gray day, and the light was very low. But it gave something. It really gave that picture magical quality.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's, I think, one of the things that that I think people probably don't understand about any professional photographer is that persistence and luck are both involved, and that when you see a photograph like that, you don't really know how many pictures that photographer had to take, how many pictures he or she took, whether they just threw them away because they were no good, in order to get those that you see. I mean, do you have any sense about how many photos you take, sort of what the ratio of throwaways to great photographs are?
I tend not to count. It varies from shoot to shoot. In fact, if it's an unproductive shoot, I'll often have more pictures because I'll be trying to work a situation over and over and over again. But you know, if there's a lot of luck in a situation, I tend to come back with fewer but better quality pictures. A lot of people say to me, you must be very patient, but in fact, I'm not patient at all. I think it's more a fear of failure. If I'm in a situation or at a particular shoot and things are not happening, I become very frustrated, and I don't want to leave without a decent picture. So I will often sit it out until something happens and endure all sorts of discomfort, because the prospect of coming home without a picture is something I really don't want to face.
Can you talk a little bit about, I mentioned in the beginning just what it says on your bio about how you were working in the graphics industry and that you then decided that what you really wanted to do was to do it, something else, to do wildlife photography like this. Was there something in particular that caused you to make that decision?
Well, I just turned 40, and my wife and I went out to South Africa, and we decided to take a safari holiday, and I took a camera along. And I took my first wildlife pictures at that point, and something happened. It was one of those life-changing experiences where you simply change direction. And I looked at those first pictures, and they weren't very good, but something struck me about our attitudes, about how we tend to live a very metropolitan, we live very metropolitan lives. We tend to think that the world stops where the sidewalks stop and there's nothing beyond that. And I began to see that there's a wider world of wildlife and all sorts of things going on there, and there are other values out there. And it really began to make, I began to become aware of the sentience of other animals and how self-centered we are and how we tend to immerse ourselves in trivial gossip and political scandals and you know, how the extent to which we delude ourselves with our arrogant beliefs that our values are the only ones. And just watching the animals and seeing how they behave really made me realize that there's something else out there, and we can learn a lot from so many animals. You know, we think we've got the monopoly on the spoken word, but elephants speak to each other using infrasound. In fact, with the recent tsunami, I've heard stories about how elephants broke their chains and fled up the hills. I can't substantiate any of these, but people have actually come back to me with these stories.
Hmm. There are just so many amazing photographs in here. Maybe I want to ask you about another one that's in the that's in the first section, the Africa section. This is the one of the great white shark, and people, I'm sure, have seen photos of whales jumping out of the water. Well, this is kind of like that, and well, maybe you can describe the picture.
Sure. I'd heard that there's a very small area near Cape Town in South Africa where great white sharks had been known to headbutt seals, toss them into the air, and then breach out of the water, just like dolphins have been seen to do. So I went out there. I tracked down the guy who had actually seen this happen, and he took me out in his boat, and we went for 16 days. And it was very frustrating because we couldn't get the shark to leap, and the weather was foul, and I sat there and I looked through the viewfinder constantly. My head throbbed and my muscles were aching from holding the camera, and eventually the shark leapt out of the water, and the whole sequence lasted something like 5/8 of a second. And I was able to get it. But that was a situation where the prospect of going home without the picture was something I just didn't want to bear. So I stuck it out. I got terribly seasick because I was looking through the viewfinder for such a long period. And, you know, obviously, if you're in that situation, you do lose your sense of balance somewhat.
Yeah. That certainly, I think, one of the things that marks a lot of your photographs is your ability to stop motion. You must be using very, very fast shutters.
Yes, I do. I think it's important for someone in my position to always be working with the most cutting-edge equipment. So the moment a new upgrade of camera comes along, I'm the first in the queue to get the camera. You know, it's a very competitive business, too.
And you're still shooting film?
No, I've been shooting digital for 1.5 years now.
Ah. Well, that's interesting. It's something that, you know, from time to time we have a guy who teaches photojournalism here at the university who has been a newspaper photographer. Occasionally he's here on the program and we talk about picture taking and also invite people to call in with questions about film and lenses and all that sort of stuff. One of the things that's really has marked our conversations and how things have changed over the recent years is how much now we talk about digital photography as opposed to having talked about film and how that has changed picture taking for both professionals and for people who either are hobbyists or are just taking pictures on vacation and holiday. Was that a difficult adjustment for you to make to go from film to digital?
For me, it was a totally natural adjustment, and I have not looked back. There are so many advantages of digital photography. There are a few advantages of film photography. There's that earthy quality you get with the grain and a few other things. But with digital photography, firstly, I used to get onto planes with 400 rolls of film, mm-hmm. and I'd carry them as hand baggage, and it caused all sorts of problems. And it's only been getting more difficult to carry that much film onto planes with the progressive increase in airline security. So now I can carry a couple of small hard drives which fit in my inside pocket and a few compact flashcards. So I mean that's a great advantage. But also I can edit now while I'm in the field. Now my evenings are spent checking and assessing the pictures I've taken, and if I've got a particular good picture of a subject, I don't have to go back and try and rework it, whereby when I was working with film, I'd have to wait until I got home, and I'd have to continually work the same thing, because I wouldn't know if I'd captured it on film or not. One of the things that happens when you're a photographer is you don't actually see what you're photographing, because for that moment, when the mirror jumps up, the eye is actually blocked off. Now I know we're talking about a split second, but so often it happens that once the film is processed, you look at the pictures and they look different from the way you would expect them to look. Now, with digital photography, you can constantly review the picture on the camera as you're shooting and make decisions on the spot. So it's a far more intuitive medium, digital photography. I constantly make the comparison between photography and music, and the camera is like a musical instrument, and I feel you're interacting with it far more when you're shooting digitally.
Well, I'm sure that you have gotten somebody like you who takes as many pictures as you do has gotten to know your camera really well, and it's become part of you, and that's perhaps one of the things that for people who shoot less is a little bit more difficult to achieve that level of connection with the instrument, so to speak. You know, for example, I think one of the things that people, when it comes to digital cameras, people find really frustrating is, how do I know when the camera has taken the picture? Because often, unless it has some sort of a device that goes ka-chunk, when you push down the button, you don't know. And then also, because many of them are so automatic, they're taking their time, they're figuring out the exposure, they're making some decisions. And often, as I say, I think this frustrates people, and they talk about it. They say, okay, I push the button. When does it take the picture? I don't imagine you have a problem like that.
Not really, no, because I'm using a top-end digital camera, and it does go clunk because it has a mirror. It's an SLR.
Oh, it's a digital SLR.
So essentially it works in a very similar way to the way the film cameras worked. Mm-hmm. And also one of the problems with digital photography is there's a time lag. With wildlife photography, where you're trying to shoot these decisive moments, you really need to know that at the split second you push your finger down on the shutter, you'll capture the photograph. Now, with some digital cameras, there's a pause of a second or two. Even if it's a small fraction of a second, that makes a difference. But with the cameras I use, it's pretty much instantaneous.
You're also using some very big lenses so that you can get the shots. You can get close up without having physically to be close up. Does the fact that is a good sized lens, and I imagine it's heavy, do you hand hold the camera most of the time, or what?
I hand hold cameras a lot of the time, often with big 500 millimeter lenses. A classic example, I was photographing in Botswana in October, and there was an elephant at a waterhole, and a group of lions came and drank at the waterhole, and the viewpoint was such that there was a rock obscuring the lions. So I jumped onto the top of my Jeep, picked up my 500mm lens, stood on my toes, and handheld it, and got a really wonderful shot of a line of lions drinking and looking up, absolutely terrified at the elephant who was about to chase them away. So, but the thing is, with the modern lenses, you have image stabilizers, which help. And with a digital camera, you can shoot at a much higher ISO rating, so you can essentially have a much faster shutter speed. So with the technology as it was 10 years ago, I would not have been able to get that picture.
One of the things that digital photography will allow you to do, maybe I should say it this way, that with digital photography, you can do all kinds of things. You can manipulate the image in ways that you could not with film. Obviously, in the darkroom, there are a lot of things that you can do, but there's only so much. Digital photography gives you the opportunity to do much more, but then that sometimes, and maybe we're really only talking here about images that are sort of documentary or news footage, their questions are raised about how much manipulation of the image is too much. What sort of things do you do to the pictures, or do you do very much to the pictures to change them in any way after you've actually taken the picture?
Absolutely, I do. You know, but for me, it's all about doing it in the context of my experience about in the context of what it was like actually being there. So. I think with manipulation, you have to understand that in many respects, all pictures are manipulated in one way or another. I think it was Susan Sontag who said, "To photograph is to frame is to exclude, and to exclude is to manipulate in one way or another." So, but from a point of view of digital manipulation, I think there's a lot you can do to bring the image out, to draw the viewer into it. You can do a lot with light and with improving exposure and just essentially giving the picture a certain feel. It was Ansel Adams who compared the negative to a musical score and the print to the performance. And in his autobiography, he wrote about the computers, which were just coming on board just before he died. And, you know, he said he was sure that one day people would be able to put his negatives on a computer and essentially interpret them in very evocative ways and in new ways. And I think that the digital manipulation process gives you opportunities to interpret and print the pictures in very emotive ways. I think there's a revolution going on in photography, which is probably not dissimilar to the revolution that took place in painting when Impressionism came along, or when the Cubists started painting and showing how you can actually, that there are other ways you can see things.
Mm. Our guest is Steve Bloom. He's a wildlife photographer, well known around the world for his work. And again, if you're interested in seeing some of it, you can go down to the bookstore and look for this book that we have talked to some about. Untamed is the title of the collection. 200 photographs here that he took over a period of 10 years all over the world, published by Abrams. Also, if you have internet access, you could also go to the website for the book, which is www.untamed.com. And there you can actually see some of the photographs as well. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about a couple of the photographs of Africa. I'm looking now at the Antarctica section, and there are some just, again, stunning images. A lot of photographs of penguins here. I'm looking at one photograph, in fact, that, again, spreads over two pages. I don't know how many penguins this is, but it's a lot.
I think I know the picture you're talking about. It's just the page is just full of penguins.
Yes, just absolutely. There certainly have to be thousands.
That was Macquarie Island, in the sub-Antarctic islands, and the water was rough and we couldn't land. I was going to Antarctica on a Russian icebreak, and that was before we reached the thick pack ice, and we were only able to go so far from it. So I used a very long lens and I photographed them from the shore, but I'd hoped to actually land on that island, but I couldn't. But so instead I got this shot, which is just a complete mass of millions of penguins.
I guess I would believe that there were millions. So I'll believe if you say millions, I will believe you.
I don't know. I haven't counted them in the picture, but well, perhaps there are half a million in that picture.
And they're all packed in together, and it's just this. Again, if you back off the photograph, it's just a mass of sort of black and white. And when you get up closer, you see. Oh, I see. That's a million penguins. It's really stunning.
Well, I felt if I used a long lens with that particular picture, I could really get a feel of just how crowded that colony is. And I've been in penguin colonies which are as crowded as that. That's very, very crowded. And what you don't get in the photograph is the smell.
Yes, I could. I guess I can imagine what that would be like. Well, I once, many years ago, had the opportunity to visit. I was in Canada, and I visited an island that was a bird sanctuary where they had puffins and terns and some of those other open sea pelagic seabirds, and it did. The smell was indeed quite striking. And I can imagine that it would be that this would have been like that, only multiply probably many times.
Absolutely.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, too. That's 800-222-9455. We have someone calling from Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Just want to prompt everybody to send some money in or listening to this. A couple of questions that you may want to ask. I don't know how technically involved you are in your work. Sounded like the last few minutes ago that you were. And right before you started talking about that, I was thinking about asking a question about the kind of lenses you're using. You mentioned the 500 millimeter. I was wondering if there's a particular brand you go for, if you can talk about that. And I was wondering where you think this thing is going. And, you know, the astronomers use that coupling devices. I was wondering if there's any chance that that sort of thing might be used, you know, in your kind of photography. And the second question deals with the, I think David said there were four pages of the zebras, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, you know, since it's digital, when they expand it, you know, in a sense, quote unquote, do the pixels show up, or how did they smear that? Or, you know, what goes on there? And I guess that's more to do with printers and everything, but I thought you might know something about it. I was interested in when you do take your pictures in, you know, and they magnify them in some way or another, whether shades are lost or anything like that, or is that where the digital thing comes in? You can start playing around with how you want to do the colors. Thank you.
Okay, the answer to the first part of your question is I only use the very best prime lenses. I've been using Canon equipment throughout. And there's a big difference in quality between the best lenses and mediocre lenses. So, but one of the advantages with the new digital cameras is the cameras with more than 8 million pixels tend to be an improvement on 35 millimeter film. Now, there's a new camera that's got 16 million pixels on it. Now, that means that a camera like that, you could blow a picture up to a giant poster. In fact, I've got some city center exhibitions opening in the early summer in Lisbon and in Birmingham in England and in Brussels. And we'll be having huge, giant blow-ups there. And the important thing is if you are working from a film image, you need to have a very good scan of it if you're making a digital enlargement. But with regard to the digital image itself, you've got to remember that what the digital camera produces nothing more than a digital negative. You then need to learn and understand something about color spaces and how to actually process that image to get the best color out of it. And this is something that a lot of people don't know because the technology itself is in its infancy at the moment.
It is, to me, really striking that some of the images have been enlarged, obviously enlarged. And so, for example, here I'm looking at a picture of in the Antarctica section of a penguin, and it's spread over two pages. And it's very close in, and you have the feeling as the viewer that you can almost count the hairs or feathers on the bird. It's in some parts of the photograph, it's that sharp. And that's, to me, that's pretty amazing that you can get that.
Well, that was done with a digital camera with 11 million pixels. So that really shows you what's possible now with digital photography.
Mm.
About 18 months ago, the first digital cameras came out which were superior to 35 millimeter film in terms of how big you can make them, as long as you process that image properly. And that was the point at which I turned to digital.
Hmm.
And the first shoot I did with a digital camera was in Canada, and the camera went down to minus 47 degrees.
And it still worked.
It still worked. I mean, I was absolutely amazed. In fact, people who were with me, their film was breaking because film becomes brittle at those temperatures. I had to be very careful not to let the back of the camera, the LCD screen, freeze. You know, that was my fear. But even in those temperatures, it just became slow and sluggish. But in fact, with a digital chip, if you have a lot of heat, the image tends to become a bit noisy, but grainy. So the colder it is, the smoother the image.
Well, it's just amazing work. And again, I know I've said this several times, but I just would suggest to people they go out and look at the book, go to the bookstore and look for Untamed and see some of the pictures because they're truly, truly impressive. Our guest is Steve Bloom, and if you'd like to call in, we are taking calls, certainly. Pledges are not required. That'd be nice, but that's not required. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm here now looking at the Eurasia section. There's a photograph of you and a panda together, sort of lying back, having a little snack. Tell me about that picture.
Yes, I presume you can tell which one is me.
Yes, it's rather obvious.
Yes, that was actually at a panda breeding center called Wolong in China. You know, pandas are so very, very endangered, and I decided I didn't want to try and photograph them in the wild. Firstly, it's very, very difficult, and also they're so endangered I didn't want to harass them. So I went to this breeding center, which is in the area where they live naturally, and they have these large areas where they can walk up the mountain and so on. And so this particular panda was habituated to people. It wouldn't have been possible to go and lie down like that with a truly wild panda. It was something I just did for fun on the spur of the moment, and my guide took the picture.
Well, it's a great picture. I'm sure you're happy to have it, in addition to the other pictures. There's some, in this particular section, there are some amazing photographs of tigers taken in snow. And there's one here that's... the picture spreads over two pages, but the main image of the tiger is makes up virtually one entire page. It's on the right side, and the tiger appears to be charging you. And it actually makes me think a little bit. There's also a photograph on the that's in the book, and it's also on the cover of the book of a bear, kind of the same photograph. It looks like it's charging you, and when I look at those photographs, and I think, how far away from this charging animal was he when he took this picture?
Okay, well, the picture of the bear was photographed in Alaska in Katmai National Park, and I was wading through the river, and the bear was actually fishing for salmon. Mm-hmm. And a salmon jumped up quite close to me, and the bear ran towards the camera. And I was quite deep in the water. I couldn't have run away. There's nothing I could do about that. So I took the picture, but the bear wasn't charging me. If the bear was charging me, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. And I got back to my hotel, and I emailed the image home, and I was really, really pleased with it.
And when they saw it at home, did someone say, "Are you nuts, Steve?"
My wife. I said to her afterwards, "Why didn't you? Weren't you scared when you saw that picture?" And she said, "Not at all, because I knew if you could email it, you were fine."
Some comfort to be taken in the fact that, well, he must still be alive because he sent me the picture. How about the one with the tiger that I also mentioned?
Okay, the tiger was done in a breeding center in northern China at a place called Harbin, and it was photographed from a bus.
Ah.
The tiger was running through the snow. It was a very lucky shot.
Yeah, and there's another one that's just remarkable here of two tigers having a little altercation also in the snow, and they've kicked up some snow, so there are specks of snow in it, and the composition is just really stunning, and they're roaring at each other, and their mouths are open, and it's just, and that's an amazing picture.
Well, that's what the French photographer Cartier-Bresson meant when he spoke about the decisive moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a question of shooting from the heart, and something happens, and there's a certain poetry in the composition that you just managed to get, and it's something, it's akin to music and poetry, as I've said before, and it's just getting the right balance and getting the right feeling into it, and something magical occasionally happens.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess when I see his pictures in particular, I think the thing that strikes me about his pictures is that they look perfectly composed, and at the same time, they look candid. And I always, when I look at the pictures and I think, well, how exactly was that achieved? And I guess that in part you've explained it. I'm not sure how much you really can explain how that happens, though.
I think as a photographer you have to look and look really hard and look carefully and just keep your eyes open and see the world and just constantly be looking and observing and seeing how things are juxtaposed against each other and just looking at compositions, and it's just, as a photographer, you kind of live your life through images.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, as I said, that occasionally we do with this fellow who teaches, he teaches young photojournalists here at the U of I, talk about picture taking, and occasionally I try to get him to give some just sort of basic tips for people who are not serious photographers but would like to make better pictures. And one of the things that he says is, when he talks a little bit about competition, first of all, he says that people, when they begin, their impulse is to take whatever it is they're going to take a picture of and put it right in the center of the frame. And he says, now, don't do that. It's often much more interesting if you don't, and that you also think a little bit about the background. And I think here, again, in what's striking about a lot of the photographs is not only have you captured the subject, but the way it's placed and the feeling particularly of depth in the photo that you can get by having different things in the background and having a, not only a strong foreground but a strong midground and a strong background, all of that really adds something to the photograph that's above and beyond the subject of the photograph. How much thinking do you do about composition, or is that something that just when you've done as much as you have, it just kind of an automatic program that runs and you don't think very much about it?
I'm aware of composition all the time while I'm photographing. I'm constantly changing lenses or recomposing in the viewfinder, and it's a question of comfort and balance. And as soon as it feels right, that's when I press the shutter. It's all to do with feeling.
I have another caller here. Someone would like to talk with you, and we're kind of getting a little short on time, so I want to make sure I get them in. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering what the name of the book is and how to spell the author's name.
Oh, well, I can do that for you. The title of the book is Untamed, and the photographer's name is Steve Bloom, B-L-O-O-M.
Okay, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. And again, for other people who would like to see some of these pictures we've been talking about, our guest, Steve Bloom, has published them, 200 images in this book. It's titled Untamed.
Could I also mention that there's a website called untamed.com,
yes,
which has pictures from the book in it.
That's
specifically
right.
About the book.
That's right. So again, if people have internet access and you would like to see some of the photos in the book, you can also do that. Go to untamed.com. Questions here, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Are there things that you think of as great missed shots? A sort of, it's the proverbial one that got away, that you it was such a great picture, and somehow for some reason you didn't get it?
There are many that got away. When I first started photographing them, I felt absolutely terrible if I'd miss a shot. I remember once waiting in Borneo for a proboscis monkey to leap into the river, and I waited for 2.5 hours in the terrible heat. And I looked away for a second, and the monkey leapt into the water, and I felt absolutely terrible, and I was depressed afterwards. And as time went by, I learned to realize that I've actually been very lucky. And I've gotten a lot of gems, and I should be pleased and effectively grateful for what I have. And I will miss certain shots. And, you know, if I miss a shot, it wasn't to be. And that's my attitude now, so I don't get morose about it anymore.
We have a caller in Chicago. Let's talk with them on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I had some technical questions relative to using the digital cameras. One is, especially when you're working in the field, batteries. It seemed to me that the batteries don't last very long in digital cameras. And the other is memory. Do you carry some kind of memory chips or something that you download your pictures to? And the third one was color. Somehow the colors on some of the digital cameras don't seem to be as natural as I would get with film. If you could address those, then I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure.
All right.
So I'll answer your last question first, color. You've got to remember that digital photography is a very different medium from film photography. Now, film is a chemical process, and it'll react in a specific way, and we're used to that. With digital, the colors are recorded differently, but as long as you've got a good camera and you process them correctly, you should be able to bring out the colors. But you're essentially comparing apples and oranges if you're talking about color with digital versus film. They are completely different processes, but with the right controls, you should be able to bring them back to what you want them to be. Second part of the question is the memory chips. Now, I tend to use 4 gigabyte compact flash cards, which are enormous, and I think for most amateur photographers, it's far more than they'd need. But I mean, I'm recording 20 megabyte images in their raw format, so I need that, and I carry 100 gigabyte portable hard drives with me and a laptop. So I download the images onto the laptop, and then I copy them onto the portable hard drive. Usually carry about 3 backups. 2 is not enough because with computers it's possible for 2 to go, so 3 is a bit safer. Now, the first part of your question was batteries. Digital cameras are much more hungry for power than the film cameras. I think it's a question of just carrying enough spare batteries and making sure that they're always recharged. If you're in very, very cold conditions, the batteries don't last as long. So it's best to, if you have a parka or something, carry the batteries inside against your body so your body heat will keep the batteries warm.
Okay. I think we're maybe getting one more caller here lined up and ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And someone listening in Loda this morning on our line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I went to the site and it is quite beautiful. Nice pictures. My question is, I'm using a digital camera, and my makeup looks different in the pictures, and I have gone and explained to my cosmetologist, and so we have changed, but in no other cameras I have that problem, but in the digital, could you give me some pointers of what could I be, the lightning perhaps?
Well, you've got to remember that there are a large number of different digital cameras on the market, and they all behave differently. And with some cameras, they may not record the colors as they should be, because I don't know what type of camera you're using. But certainly with the professional cameras, from a professional point of view, there are certain controls you can use to make the camera record the image as you want it to do. But if you don't actually have that control, the camera won't always record things as you might see them. Because, for instance, if you have different lighting, that will effectively influence the colors that will be reproduced on the chip.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. And I think we have a cell phone caller here, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I tuned in halfway through the program, and I'm so sorry that I missed the first half. This has been a splendidly enlightening. The question I have concerns charge coupled devices, and I assume that in the last year or two, there have been huge improvements in their manufacture. I know that 2 or 3 years ago, there was what I always called a megapixel scam, and marketing departments could market more pixels, but the sad truth is the signal-to-noise ratio was poorer the larger the number of pixels. So I assume there's been some kind of development where now it really does give better resolution and a cleaner picture to have more pixels, and I wonder if you could comment. The second thing I'd like to know is that some cameras advertise that you can use 35 millimeter lenses with a digital camera, and I wonder about that. I think there are probably problems with the focal length. And I'll hang up and listen to your comment.
All right.
Okay, well, I use the CMOS sensors, not the CCD sensors, not the charge-coupled device sensors, and full frame size, so I can use the same lenses that I use with 35mm film. But these are at the top end of the scale, and the quality is absolutely superb. You know, the prices for digital cameras vary from quite low to pretty expensive, and essentially you do get what you pay for in this field. Certainly the chip qualities are improving all the time, and there was a big debate as to whether the CCD or the CMOS sensors, which were better than which, but certainly the Canon cameras I use now have gone the CMOS route, and the results of these are absolutely superb. The pixel quality, I think, is fine.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. I wish we could keep going, but we're here at the end of the time. Again, for people who want to look at the book, Untamed, look out for it in the bookstore by our guest, Steve Bloom. Also, you can go to the website for the book, which is www.untamed.com, and see the pictures as well. Mr. Bloom, we just want to say thank you very, very much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thank you so much. From a lovely day in England.
Well, there we'll have to close out this part of Focus. Programming here is made possible, by the way, by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming three of the most distinctive voices in jazz today, Herbie Hancock, Michael Brecker, and Roy Hargrove, for their Directions and Music series, an exploration of the jazz of our times. For more information or tickets, visit krannertcenter.com. The broadcast also made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers a collection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes made from pure wool or silk pile, designed to add beauty to any decor, whether homes or offices. We have a couple minutes here. Jack Brighton is in the studio with us, the man we like to call our producer emeritus of Focus 580, to ask people to support this station and this show.
That's right. And the way you can do that is make a pledge call right now to 217-244-9455. And folks, it's not that we want your support. It's that we really need your support to keep this show going. Everything on the air on WILL, people talk about how much they love the local programming here. And that's, we feel, is prime for us as far as our mission is concerned. It's extremely important for us to keep that going. And the way we do that is by asking for your support every once in a while. 217-244-9455 to make that pledge call. And we had somebody call in with a challenge for us during Focus 580 today. Let's check in with Maeve Riley, who is with the phone volunteers in our pledge center. And what are the details? What do we got on the table here, Maeve?
Right. A good friend of WILL, Bert Gray, would like to encourage new friends to join and become friends like him. He'll pay half of the next 10 pledges by new friends at the basic membership level of $40. So if you've been thinking about becoming a friend of WILL, all you have to do is put in $20 and Bert Gray will put in the other $20 for you, and then you'll be a full friend of WILL. The number to call is 217-244-9455.
This service depends on large numbers of our listeners phoning in with that $20, $40 contribution, whatever it is that you are comfortable with to become a friend of WILL. You hear the voices of the phone volunteers in the background, mm-hmm. but no phones ringing. So let's do something about that right now. 217-244-9455. Make that pledge call.
All right, we got to take a break here for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
And of course,